So this is particularly poignant for me, this quote. This book meant an awful lot to me at a certain time. It still does now to an extent, but Saturday was the anniversary of my father's death. So my father died 16 years ago, almost exactly 16 years ago. And he died quite suddenly. But just before he died, this book had fallen into my hands and I'd started reading it. And then he died, and I carried on reading it. And that paragraph really, really stood out for me. And around that time, I started thinking quite seriously about what I wanted the purpose of my life to be. So I say started. It took an awful long time to get on with that process of sifting out what I really wanted to do with my life. But it certainly began when my dad died. It was a very, very sudden shift for me. So just to give you a bit of background, I first learned to meditate. I first came along to a Tree Ratna Buddhist Center when I was 22. I'm now 40, so that's about 18 years ago. So I'd started meditating when I was about 22, back in 1997. And my dad died a few years after that, two or three years after that. So I'd been meditating for a couple of years by that point. And a lot of things shifted when he died. At the time I was living in Liverpool, had a very, very good life. I was working for a charity, which is what I still do now. Was enjoying myself, having a very nice time, having quite a hedonistic life. And things were very, very good, but in a way they were almost a little bit too easy. I was reflecting a bit on my dad, sort of because of the weekend and also because I was giving this talk. And my dad gave me a lot of gifts, I think it's fair to say. He was a very good example to me. He was a very good man, a very ethical man. And one of the things that he gave me, which my mum and dad both gave me actually, was a real sense of freedom, that basically I could do what I wanted with my life. There was no pressure on me to do anything at all. I remember my dad very clearly saying, "Son, I don't mind what you do as long as you're happy. As long as what you're doing makes you happy, I really don't mind." And my mum told me years later that he said that he would never worry about me. And the quote that he used was, he said, if he was dropped behind enemy lines and he was starving, he would know how to steal a loaf of bread. Which I'm not really sure what I make of that. But I think basically what it means is he knew I'd always be all right. But yeah, so he gave me lots of gifts, and the last gift that he gave me was unintentional, and that was when he died, I suddenly had this sense that time was very precious and time was very short, because he was 49 when he died, and I thought, gosh, if I live to be the same age as him, I'm more than halfway through. That's what I thought at the time. So after he died, I'm not going to sort of tell my whole life story, but sighs of relief from the room. I moved to Calcutta soon after he died. I had the opportunity to do that because of the charity that I was working for, and had the opportunity to go and live and work there. So I went and lived for a year in Calcutta, and my life was never the same after that, basically. It sort of turned my life upside down in a good way, and my life was never the same afterwards. But I first came along here about 7 years ago, and I was at a bit of a crossroads in my life, and had decided that I wanted to make some changes. So I'd just had a very, very painful relationship breakup, and I knew that I sort of wanted to make certain changes in my life. So I came along and was sort of much more involved when I came along to the LBC, got involved very quickly, became a mitra, was quite serious about my meditation practice. But when I asked for ordination, I remember quite clearly one of the thoughts that led me to that. So for those of you that have been here and know a little bit, basically to be ordained in our order, You have to you ask freely to be ordained, and that choice comes from you, and you start a training process whereby you go on certain retreats and you deepen your practice and your friendships and all of that sort of thing until you're ready for ordination. And the reason, one of the reasons why I asked for ordination was at the time, I was just finishing up doing a master's in music composition. So music's always been very important to me, and it was a bit of a dream come true for me that I got to go back to university and study music at a master's level. And I was really, the thought hit me very strongly. When I started doing that course, the music I was making really wasn't very good. It was decidedly average and didn't show much promise, I didn't think. But what I'd done was I decided to just take a chance and throw myself in and immerse myself in very strong conditions for 2 years, i.e. studying masters at Goldsmiths, which was one of the best places to study the creative arts. And I arrived and I suddenly found myself with this peer group of people that were really knew what they were doing. They were fantastic. So I had to up my game very quickly. And by the end of a couple of years, I'd made really, really quite a lot of headway. I'd made quite a lot of progress. The music that I was making I thought was quite promising. I'm not sure anyone else thought of it, but and I just noticed that, and it's such a simple thing to notice, but whatever conditions we choose to put ourselves in, that's going to have an effect on our life and what we do in our life. And I noticed that with those particular conditions. And it just sort of hit me, and I thought, well, what am I doing with my practice? What am I doing with meditation? What am I doing in my... I mean, I don't like these clunky phrases, but what am I doing in my sort of Dharma life or my spiritual life? And I sort of realised that if I wanted to make serious progress, I would need to do the same sort of thing as what I'd done with my music, i.e. make a commitment and put myself in very positive conditions. So that's what I decided to do. And on the day I handed in my master's portfolio, I asked for ordination. And the other thing that struck me as well was, this was a bit of a tangent, but I'd always sort of had this idea that, you know, they say never meet your heroes, and I'd kind of had this idea that anyone who's really, really sort of accomplished and really creative and really amazing in a particularly creative field, I don't know why, I always sort of had the impression that people would be sort of all-round impressive people. And I remember sort of talking to my lecturers at Goldsmiths who were, you know, they weren't nasty people or anything, there's nothing wrong with them. But I remember sort of thinking, oh, you're just really developed in this particular area. You're not sort of really developed all round. I don't know if that makes sense for people. It sounds a bit daft, really, and a bit obvious, but I sort of remember thinking that. And I thought, oh, okay, right. So it's important to think about what areas of your life do you want to develop in, because if you develop one, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to become sort of rounded in all the other areas. And I think when I'd come along here, I was talking with a friend about this the other day. When I came along here, I started seeing and observing people who'd been practicing Buddhism for a long time and noticing the effect that it had and the sort of people that they were. I came from quite a hedonistic background. So in the place where I grew up, there was a big party scene, and I'd been a DJ for a long time, and I'd always been sort of interested in counterculture. So because of that, got very into kind of taking psychedelics and taking class A drugs and things like that. And at a certain point, I noticed the effect that that would have on people that had been doing it way too long, basically. So I would meet people from time to time. You know, we used to call them casualties, you know, people that had been sort of doing this for like 20, 30 years, and they thought they were onto something. But you know that line in the film with Nell and I, where he says, look at him, his mechanism's gone. It was a bit like that. You'd sometimes meet people and their mechanism had gone. And I think that's a really good maxim in life sometimes is you think, well, if you want to commit to something and if you want to do something, have a look at the people who've been doing it for a long time in the context that you want to do it in, and basically see if you want to be like them. And I knew what I didn't want to be, but I came along here and I met, you know, Mitras and people who were studying, and, you know, I sort of met order members, and I just thought, particularly about some of them, I thought, God, if I can be a bit more like you in a few years, that'd be great. That's sort of good enough for me, really. So I asked for ordination and began the training process of sort of moving more towards ordination. Also around that time as well, I'd started working. I was running this project in Tower Hamlets for about 6 years, where I was doing workshops and discussion groups with older people. And I really loved that work. And one of the things I loved about it was that it was a real privilege to be able to mix with people who were reflecting back on their life in their 70s, 80s, 90s, some people were even into their 100s. And it was a real window on, you know, the sort of things that people would say. They would say, well, when I look back on my life, I'm proud of this, or this is what I regret, or... And in some ways, I think it would be helpful for all younger people to have that sort of opportunity. You know, most of the time we just meet our grandparents. We don't really mix much with many older people. But one of the things that you'll notice is that there are some older people that have a real sense of satisfaction about their lives. And most of them are people that have found a set of values to live by, even if that's raising their family in a particular way or serving a particular cause or something like that. And that really stood out for me at the time. So I just wanted to say something briefly about why I felt that this order was right for me. So I'd been involved with a few other Buddhist movements over the years. So I'd been involved with Rigpa for a little bit, which is Sogyal Rinpoche is involved with. I've been on other retreats. I've been at Amaravati, which is a Theravada monastery just outside of London. I briefly was involved with the Nyukadampa tradition. And why I really, this movement really appealed to me is that I really, really wanted to make a commitment, but I definitely am not cut out to be a monk. And there are various reasons for that, but I just felt like I wanted to make a firm commitment to something, but an order which is, you can commit but not necessarily have to sort of commit to monastic life, and you can be in the city and enjoy, you know, culture and all of those sorts of things, but still make a firm commitment. I also felt quite strongly that I wanted to commit to something for the rest of my life, and that was quite important for me. So I'd sort of made the decision fairly early on in my life that I didn't want to have children, that I didn't want to get married, that I didn't want to have a career or for any of those things to be the focus of my life. But I did want to commit to something which I could live out that commitment for the rest of my life. And in certain other orders, it's like people ordain for short periods of time, you know, for 3 months, for 2 years, for 5 years, whereas I wanted to do something for the rest of my life. I also really liked, in our order, there's what we call the distinct emphases of what used to be called the FWBO, or now Tri Ratna, which are the emphases of our movement, which are slightly different from other movements. And one of those that really appealed to me was our emphasis on creativity and the arts, which is very, very important to me. And experientially, I sort of felt that I wanted that to be part of my path. So that's why I wanted to particularly commit to this movement. So something I've been thinking about a little bit recently, I've just come back from 2 weeks in India with the work that I do. I work for a charity called Karuna that some of you will know is part of the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order. And I'll probably say a bit more about that later. But I've just come back from 2 weeks in India and really seeing how people live there and the conditions that people are living in and the things that we take for granted, and more broadly, I've been sort of reflecting on what a privileged life I lead. I'll just talk about myself. I mean, it's probably easier if I do it that way. I mean, I think it's true of all of us, really, but it's probably easier if I just talk about myself. What a privileged life I live, really. I mean, as I said, I had quite a nice upbringing. There's no pressure on me particularly to do anything. And if I look at how society's changed to support those conditions, I mean, it's relatively recently that that would have been completely different. I mean, I was thinking about my grandfather, for instance. He was a coal miner. And he became a coal miner at the age of 14. And he passed his 11 plus, which meant, you know, that he could have gone to grammar school, could have gone to probably on to higher education. But literally, the reason why he couldn't do that was because his family couldn't afford to buy him a school uniform. So they couldn't afford to clothe him to go to school, to buy the uniform, and he had to start earning money. So in South Wales, which is where he came from, basically working class people go down the mine, that's what they did. So he started coal mining when he was 14, doing, you know, 12-hour shifts on his hands and knees with a pickaxe. And he did that until he couldn't do it anymore because his lungs gave out. And when I contrast my life with that, it's just, it's almost too ridiculous to think about. All of my material needs are taken care of. I've got all of this choice, I've got all of this privilege. You know, I can wholly sort of pretty much be the author of my own life. So I've got all these choices. But then the important thing is, I think, well, to what end, though? Because I think, I mean, it's interesting. I don't know if anyone's been watching this this series on iPlayer recently called The Men Who Made Us Spend. Has anyone seen that? It's been a very, very good series about the birth of consumerism and conspicuous culture. So from about the 1940s, 1950s, you know, society has really changed in Western Europe and in the States. So we've got an infinite number of choices. We've got more money, our material needs are taken care of. But what do most of us do with that choice, and I include myself in this to a certain degree, well, we spend, don't we? We want more leisure and we want to earn more money so that we can spend more money, and we've turned spending money into a leisure activity. And this is like sort of the pinnacle of our culture, isn't it? Or it's, you know, this is how our culture sort of functions. So we've got all this privilege, we've got all this choice, but what do we do with it? So these are the sort of questions that I've been asking myself, really, for quite a few years. So I think after my dad died, I decided that I wanted to take life seriously. I wanted to be serious about my life and apply myself to my life. But the paradox of that, I think, is that once you... Well, my experience has been that if you make a commitment to the Dharma, to spiritual life, you're taking life seriously. But there's so much joy in that. There's so much lightness and laughter and fun, and I feel lighter and easier than I ever have done in my life before. But it's that lovely paradox of taking things seriously, but having fun and having lightness. Yeah. So this might not feel particularly... like there's a strong narrative thread going through this. I'm just talking about ideas that I've had about ordination, but hopefully it's making sense to you so far. But I thought I'd... what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop every so often and just see if people have got questions. Yeah, so that's the end of a kind of a little section. Does anyone have anything they want to ask so far? Don't feel you have to.
Do you mind reading the quote again that you began?
Yeah.
It's not so resonant.
Yeah. Yeah. The Master said that there is one thing in this world which must never be forgotten. If you were to forget everything else, but were not to forget this, there would be no cause to worry. While if you remembered, performed, and attended to everything else, but forgot that one thing, you would in fact have done nothing whatsoever. It's as if a king had sent you to a country to carry out one special, specific task. You go to the country, and you perform 100 other tasks. But if you've not performed the task you were sent for, it's as if you've performed nothing at all. So man has come into the world for a particular task, and that's his purpose. If he doesn't perform it, he will have done nothing. Okay. So at a certain point, a few years ago, I found out that I was going to be invited for ordination, basically. So that's how it works, is you take part in a training process where you go on ordination training retreats, and then at a certain point the people, the order members that know you, decide that you're ready to take on the commitment of ordination, and you're invited for ordination. So the training process for me had been absolutely joyous. I really, really enjoyed it. I really, really liked going to Padmaloka, which is where the men's ordination training retreats happened, because it was a lovely chance. It was my first experience of being on retreat with other people that were really sort of as committed as I was, and there's a lovely atmosphere that comes with that, I found, particularly around ritual and puja. And it was just such a privilege to be able to spend time and listen to the men that run that retreat centre, who very, very experienced teachers and practitioners, who are just incredibly warm and friendly and inspirational. So I really, really enjoyed that time. And then I was invited for ordination, and as Sila Pia said before, most people are ordained within, well, if you're a man, a context for 4-month retreat in southern Spain. So just saying that actually makes me go a bit kind of like, whoa, 4 months retreat, 4 months. So yeah, and that was just great. It was fantastic. There was 17 men all being ordained. So I knew quite a few of them because we'd been going on sort of this, you know, some of the same ordination training retreats. I knew some of them from, they came to this centre. There was 4 of us from the LBC being ordained together. So I remember very clearly when we arrived, I've got a real addiction to caffeine. And I remember when we arrived, we all got together the next morning, and I hadn't been able to get strong enough coffee, and I slept in on the first morning and sort of fell into the shrine room, and was feeling really disorientated. And then in the sort of middle of the morning, all of us got together and checked in about how we were and how we were doing, and I was feeling a bit frazzled, but I looked round and I just thought, gosh, we're all going to be on retreat together for 4 months. That's incredible, isn't it? And it just, yeah, it was just great. And it was such a positive experience. I mean, living together, working together, studying together, it was like a little sort of, like a sort of ordination training camp, like a little community. And as Sila Pia said, you know, there's no days off or anything. So it's the same thing every day, which is wonderful when you're in the mood for it, and it's very challenging when you're not in the mood for it. But even when it's challenging, it's still wonderful. And you really, really, really get... I mean, it was a unique thing, really, because, you know, I might be on retreat for that long again at some point in the future, but I certainly had been on retreat for anything like as long at that point. So I remember there's a period of... in the middle of the retreat, your preceptors come out, you, the people that are going to ordain you. In the lead up to that, you've got 2 weeks of total silence. We called it Vajra silence. So there's different kinds of silence. There's silence in the retreat centre, but you can go for a walk if you want to. There's silence at certain times. But Vajra silence means everybody's silent all the time for 2 weeks, which is a very long time when you're in that kind of silence. And it was such a strong experience because we'd already had 6 weeks of retreat up to that point, and then to go into 2 weeks of complete silence, my meditation just completely blossomed, and I contacted parts of myself that I didn't even know were there. I mean, for me in particular, there was a lot of anger actually. So an awful lot of stuff that I think had been buried for years and years and years. I mean, anyone that knows me knows that I'm, you know, quite an optimistic, chirpy sort of person. And suddenly I was like, God, there's all of this black anger is coming out from somewhere. Where is it coming from? But it was coming out. And actually, I think looking at it in a really positive light, what's happening is all the deepest, darkest bits of you come out in order that every single bit of you is transformed at ordination. There's nothing left behind. And I just thought that was a really, really wonderful thing. I mean, near the start of the retreat as well, you have a period where you confess all of your ethical shortcomings throughout your life. And that was a real privilege as well, to be in a group with people doing that. And some things came up for me that had been buried in my subconscious since I was a child, and some of it was quite serious. And it was such a moving thing to be able to just talk about those things and be completely heard and completely seen by people that you loved and respected. So that was the sort of lead up to the ordination period. And then you there's a 2 week period where you have your private ordination and your public ordination. And in your private ordination, you are ordained by your private preceptor. So that's somebody who you have asked to ordain you, and you have a close relationship with them. They know you very well. So in my case, that was Nyanavacha. The private ordination ceremony is probably the most magical thing that's happened to me in my life, actually. And I still don't quite know what that was or why that was, but what happens is, on a sort of a mundane level, you go into this tiny little thing called the ordination kuti, I think it's called, isn't it? And you step into it, and it's a bit like Alice in Wonderland, because it's this really tiny little door that you go in, and it's sort of lit, but it was sort of full of these Buddha figures and beautifully lit. So you feel like you go through this tiny thing and suddenly you're in this sort of TARDIS-like world. And the Nyanavacha that I met there wasn't quite like the Nyanavacha that I know. So you know when we're given a new name at ordination, and your name is like, it's like you sort of perfected. So Nyanavacha was talking about this last week. He's saying, it's not you yet. It's like the you that you'll become when you're enlightened. And it's really strange. I feel like I met proper Nyanavacha in the ordination stupa. He somehow seemed perfect and even more beautiful than he usually is. And it was really, really lovely. And I suspect I was probably in a very good state as well, but there's no mirrors in there, so you can't see. But so it's like the highest in you meets the highest in your public in your private preceptor, and then you go through this ceremony, which links you with a tradition that goes all the way back to the Buddha. So when people would go for refuge to the Buddha, they would chant the refuges. And your teacher would sort of lead that. You do it in call and response, and it's the same thing that you do. So it's like you have a link all the way back to the Buddha. You're making the same commitment that people would have done in the Buddha's day, and that hundreds of thousands, millions of people have made that commitment since. So you make these ordination vows. And the vows are, with loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. For the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. So in a certain kind of sense, your ordination's nothing to do with you. It's not personal in that sense. It's you, it is in the sense that it's you making that commitment, but you're doing it wholly in service of something that is much higher than you, and that you, my experience is that I can only begin to understand what that means at the moment, but as time goes on it unfolds more and more. But I'm going to read these verses out again, actually, I think, because it's very important. So, with loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. For the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. So, as I said, as part of your private ordination, you're also given a new name. And for me, that was a really, really joyous thing. I think it's not uncommon to have a bit of anxiety about your name, because it's going to be your name for the rest of your life. And I wanted to use it in all the contexts of my life. And it was funny, in the days leading up to ordination, all of that just fell away. And I had this really wonderful feeling after. So Jnanavacha gave me my name, which is lovely, because, you know, I love and respect him so much. And it's like he gave me that gift, which is my name. So my name, Akasha, means to radiate or to shine, and it also means space or infinite space. And Mitra means friend. So it's like something like radiant, shining friend of infinite space, which is quite a lot to live up to. But what a wonderful path to tread. So it's, yeah, it's like your name is your sort of path to ordination. And I had this really lovely feeling when he'd given me the name. I can't quite put my finger on it, but it was almost like it felt familiar. And it was like I'd reached the point where I could step into my name for the first time. It's like, it's very difficult to explain this, but it's a bit like there'd been this parallel track had been going along in my life, and I was ready to sort of step across and step into being Akasha Mitra, which was wonderful. Yeah, so it was really, really felt like a real gift. And there's a special puja that we were doing a lot on the retreat, which is a puja from the lines of the Bodhicharya Vatara, and it's a very long puja, Buddhist ritual that we were doing. So we did a puja every night, and we did this puja quite regularly, and there were some lines in it that really summed up kind of how I felt after ordination. So I'm just going to read that out. As the Buddhas of ancient times grasped this Bodhi heart and followed resolutely the practice of the Bodhisattva path, so shall I awaken this precious heart for the welfare of the world, and I too shall follow that path in all its fullness. And like a wise man who joyfully seizes that Bodhi heart, I shall rejoice so that it will grow and thrive in me. Today my birth has borne fruit, and my humanity has been fulfilled. Today I am reborn in the Buddha family, and I am now a son of the Buddha, and now I must live up to my birth. So that really, really struck a chord in me. It was like, I felt like everything that happened to me in my life up to that point had converged to ordination. As so many things, so many threads really came together. And the other thing that happens at your private ordination is you're introduced to a meditation practice on a particular figure that inspires you of your choosing. And that also felt for me like there were lots and lots of threads that had come together around that figure. So things that had been really resonant for me since I was a young boy, and things that I had caught my imagination since I was a child and much older, had sort of coalesced around that figure and my name and ordination. So there's a composer that I really love, that I'm very, has been a big influence on me, called John Cage. And I just basically always like to put a couple of John Cage talks in quotes in any talk I do. But he says, we're involved in a life that passes understanding, and our highest business is our daily life. We are involved in a life that passes understanding, and our highest business is our daily life. So that's all fine, isn't it? I've been talking a lot about these lofty ideals, but there's also your life. You know, that informs your life, whatever your ideals and your values are. And these ideals and values that I've been talking about are what I place my heart upon. They're the thing that I hold most dear. But that trickles down into sort of day-to-day life. And what has been interesting for me, being asked to do this talk really, I've just been thinking, well, what effect has it really had on my life, ordination? You know, has my life actually been different? Am I different? I mean, I'm probably not... Asking myself that isn't necessarily the most effective thing to do. I probably need to ask some other people as well, like my partner and my family and my friends. But I've been thinking about, okay, well, what's happened in the last year? If I could begin to put my finger on how my life has changed, what might that be? And one of the things is, I do definitely feel clearer. There's less ambivalence in my life, and there's definitely less of that thing that I have to a certain extent. I mean, I'm sure we all have to a certain extent, but you know that thing where we're, I clock this a lot in myself on the ordination retreat, which is just this thing of thinking, oh well, if I could change this, then things would be fine. Or why don't you do this? Or why don't you do that? Or constantly trying to measure my experience and thinking about whether it's as good as how my life was 2 years ago. Or if I could just change this, things would be much better. And it's partly around sort of weighing things up and trying to make the right decision all the time. So giving myself choices about the things that I want to do. And it's interesting, Jnanavacha last week was saying that in a certain kind of sense, the commitment of ordination, I mean, he described commitment as a dirty word in our culture, which I can see why he would say that. The commitment of ordination, partly what you're doing is you are narrowing down your choices. And you definitely are doing that. And the effect that that's had on me has been incredibly positive, actually. I remember after my public ordination, I had this really strong sense that obviously everything that I do in the rest of my life is important. Like, that's not... I'm not questioning that. But I did have this sort of sense that I'd made the most important choice. I didn't need to worry about making the big choice anymore. And, you know, that choice is basically, you know, when we sort of think, okay, well, what am I going to do with my life? I don't feel like I need to ask myself that question anymore. And it relates a little bit back to this Sogyal Rinpoche quote that I said at the beginning and just now. I'm not wasting as much of my time basically sort of wandering and faffing around. I gave Fiona's smiling there. I gave a talk on the winter retreat a few years ago where I talked extensively about faffing, the difference between pottering and faffing. And, you know, you have this idea that if you have free time, you'll use it really constructively and you'll do things that you enjoy and things like that. But actually, well, the reality for me is I spend a lot of time faffing. And it's like, it's not like 100% of me is behind the commitment that I've made all the time. But because I was able to make a commitment from the best part of myself, that one massive commitment has taken care of so many other things in my life, because it just means that I don't give myself the choice in a practical sense. And although that sounds counterintuitive and it sounds unpleasant, it's actually wonderful. It's such a relief, because it means I'm doing stuff so much of the time that is actually really helpful for me and other people, rather than just faffing. So I remember, like, when I first started coming to this class, and I used to come along on a Monday night, and I used to always think, oh, shall I go tonight? So Monday night, shall I go to the class? And then at a certain point I thought, well, why don't I just join the team? Because if I do that, then I won't give myself a choice. If I'm ill, I won't go, but otherwise I'll just go to the class. And it's funny, I see that a lot in all the things that I'm doing now. A good deal of the time, I don't necessarily want to do things that I know are good for me, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this. I'm in a Mitra study group with Alex there, and I notice that sometimes before Mitra study I think, you know, if I wasn't doing this tonight, I could just, I could just have some free time. I could just, I don't know, do something really, really important and life-changing, like watch something on iPlayer or something like that, you know. But I don't do that because I've made a commitment. And 99.9 times out of 100, 100 times out of 100, I'm always really happy to be there. Generally, you know, straight away. But there's this bit of us that resists, isn't there? But I suppose what I'm saying is that, you know, the long and short of what I'm saying is I've made this large commitment, and that takes care of so many other things in my life. The work that I do, going on retreat regularly, you know, whatever it is. I mean, it was the same with this talk. It's funny, isn't it? I was so resistant to doing this. And, you know, I was on the train coming back from a friend's house in Brighton yesterday, and I was thinking, you know, I must think about this, I must do this. And I was doing it, and I knew that actually once I'm here and I'm talking, it's fine. But we just resist things, don't we? Or I just resist things anyway. Okay. Yeah, I would say there's less ambivalence in me, and overall I feel like my life has a sense of coherency and consistency, which it didn't have in the same way before ordination. So Nyanavacha last week was saying that there are definitely no guarantees with ordination, and I just wanted to sort of reiterate that, really. It's interesting. I was listening to, as preparation for this talk, I was listening to a talk called Life as an Order Member by a man called Surita, who's a wonderful, very funny, very enthusiastic, very experienced teacher. And he says it's not a promotion, it's got nothing to do with status, you're doing it for nothing, and you're signing a blank check. In actual fact, your ordination is just the start of your spiritual life, in a certain kind of sense, and all you've done is dive off a diving board, and you don't know what you're going to land in. Which I thought was great. So let's see where we land. But I suppose what he's getting at there, which is something that I had quite a clear sense of this a couple of years ago. It's funny, I do a lot of running, and I like running because sometimes things just knock me on the head when I'm running. Not literally, but it's like I'll be running along, there's a tree branch, and no, I'll be running along, and suddenly it's like, ah, right, okay. Like I'll get something in a way that I hadn't. Something to do with the physical exertion and the mental space. But I saw this really clearly. I thought, God, I could spend my whole life practicing the Dharma. I could be ordained, I could teach, I could lead retreats, I could do all these sorts of things, and at the end, I'll have nothing to show for it. And I can't quite explain that, and I think it probably is important to qualify it, because I feel like it's the best thing I can do with my life. But what I mean by that is, in worldly terms, you might have nothing. There's no guarantees as such. And we live in a culture that emphasizes accumulation and renown and fame and acclaim and all those things. And none of that is going to happen if you seriously commit to spiritual life. But for me, I just thought, well, that's fine. My experience of this life is that although it's on its own terms, it's not on worldly terms, it's richer and fuller and more beautiful than anything I ever thought I would experience before. It's just so, it doesn't exist in the world. It's not about worldly values. Yeah. So sort of leading on from that, it's interesting as well. I didn't really have any expectations for my life. It's funny. I had particularly low expectations for myself, I think, in some ways. I didn't ever really expect, I think, when I was young, to do anything significant with my life. I'm not sure quite what I expected, but I didn't really expect much. I had quite low expectations of myself. And I think through this path I've found a life that is richer and more beautiful and more bursting with significance and meaning than I ever even thought I could sort of begin to even approach as a child, as a teenager, as a young adult. So having said everything that I said before, it's like my life is much, much, much fuller than I ever thought it would be. In the last 4 months or so I started working for this for this charity, Karuna, that I mentioned before. So I've been working in the charity sector since I was 21 or 2, around about the same time I came to the Dharma. Working with lots of different projects, as I said, working in India, working as a trainer and consultant. And about 4 months ago, the opportunity came up to start working with Karuna, which I took. And again, it was quite interesting seeing my response around that, which was I just decided that I would just commit. So no matter what happened, I would commit to doing this for at least a few years and see what happened. And that's made it really straightforward. I mean, it's been a really wonderful experience so far as well. But so I've just come back from 2 weeks in India, and when I was out there, I particularly spent a week. I spent in Nagpur, which is a sort of centre of new Buddhist activities. Lots of order members there doing lots of social work and lots of really interesting things. And the welcome that I received there it just blew my mind. I mean, it literally moved me to tears at times. That I couldn't believe that I could go to the other side of the world, but because I meet with these people who the most important thing in their life is the most important thing in my life, we've undergone a similar ordination, we have shared values and a shared vision, and I think it's something to do with the fact that they're just really wonderful people in that part of the world as well, but I was welcomed with such a warmth that it just blew me away. It was incredible. And on the last day that I was in this place, Nagpur, they had this big ritual to welcome their new order members. And they asked me to be part of that, which I felt a little bit like I was sort of crashing their party, but they insisted. They said, no, we're welcoming you as well. So, and I was there with all of these men who had been welcomed into the order, which was really, really lovely. And there's about 300 people there, 300 Indian people there, and somebody was translating for me, and I was talking a little bit about my experience. And I just had a moment where I just thought, God, how did I get here? How did this happen? And it's lovely. It's just such a such a wonderful opportunity, really. So I'm going to start winding up. I just want to make one more point, which is about, for me in particular, ordination has had a particular effect around around commitment and maturing as well. So historically I've been a little bit resistant to commitment in my life, particularly where there's intimacy involved, in particular, particularly in the area of intimate relationships. So I've had difficulty committing to things, other areas in my life as well. But what I've noticed is, over the years, with sort of serious spiritual practice, is that in a sense, I've sort of grown up, and almost without thinking, that part of me that was resistant to commitment has just sort of fallen away. And it was funny, I had some therapy a few years ago. It sort of didn't feel like therapy, because it was this man called Attila that some of you will know, who's not really a therapist, he's more of a sort of a mythic magician. But the issue that I was mainly talking to him about, or I was trying to, I mean, he clocked me as soon as I walked in, and he started to work his magic on me, but was around commitment, just not being able to commit. And I remember I had about 6 or 7 sessions with him, and at the end of that, I asked for ordination and I moved in with my partner. And he sort of said, well, hang on a minute, on the one hand you're committing to this spiritual ideal, and on the other hand you're moving in with your romantic partner. And I just sort of thought, yeah, but it's all commitment, isn't it? But for me, that was very, very positive. It's like I'm just able to commit, which is really lovely. And I remembered something very significant around this, which is something that happened a lot in my childhood, and it's come back recently. I had this recurring dream when I was a child, and it's come back, and I've had it 2 or 3 times recently since ordination. And it's almost like the dream has come back to remind me of the fact that I had the dream and to tell me what the dream was about. And it's really amazing. When I was a child, I dreamt quite regularly about a tree and basically the soil, big tree like an oak tree, and the earth was all cut away, and in the roots of the tree was money. And I, as a child, I didn't understand this. Like, this is obviously a deeply significant mythic dream. As a child, I just used to get excited about the fact that there was all these 50 pences in the roots. But actually, what that was, now I know, was that there's treasure, there's something of real value. But the real value is down deep in amongst the roots. It's not on the surface. It's like you have to get in there and really get soil under your nails and do the work in order to find the real treasure. But the treasure are in the roots of the tree. And so I don't probably need to say much more about that. But so as I said, I worked for a long time with older people, and the thing that really, really stood out for me about that was almost being given the gift of being able to look forwards and thinking, okay, well, what is it that I actually really want to do with my life? What is it that I want to be proud of? Or what is it that what are the values that I want to live by? And so it's like I've sort of arrived at that conclusion that I just need to do this one thing. And there's so much that comes out of that. But as I was saying, after my public ordination, I had this immense sense of relief that I'd done the one thing that I need to do. I'd kind of nailed my colours to the flag. And it's not like I could just relax for the rest of my life. But I know, for me personally, I know that this is a lifelong commitment that I've made. And no matter how difficult it gets, I'll see it through. And the result of that has been a real joyful life, and that you know, starting to really find that treasure that's in the roots of the tree. So I'm going to finish just by reading this quote again, and then there's probably a few minutes for questions as well if anyone's got questions. The Master said, "There is one thing in this world which we must never be forgotten. If you were to forget everything else, but were not to forget this, there would be no cause to worry. While if you remembered, performed, and attended to everything else, but forgot that one thing, you would in fact have done nothing whatsoever. It's as if a king had sent you to a country to carry out one special, specific task. You go to the country and you perform 100 other tasks. But if you've not performed the task you were sent for, it's as if you've performed nothing at all. So man has come into the world for a particular task, and that's his purpose. If he doesn't perform it, he will have done nothing." So thanks. So there's a bit of time for questions if anyone's got any questions.
Leading me in a gravitational pull of the world or what have you, or keeping that inspiration fresh. Have you got any thoughts on that? Or it's so clear, maybe you haven't had to deal with that so much. But
yeah, I mean, I think in terms of keeping inspiration fresh, it's probably less of an issue for me at the moment, isn't it? Because I'm quite newly ordained, but I have a feeling for me personally that it's probably going to be something around continually taking on new challenges, and even though I'm sort of grimacing saying this, maybe something around taking on responsibility as well. I mean, that's sort of how it's a funny thing, but I've found inspiration through sort of challenging myself and taking on responsibilities sometimes that I haven't been wholly wanted to take on. I don't know, I don't feel like I've run particularly dry as yet. Shall we meet up in a few years?
I mean, there's a reason why you should have those patches, but I'm just interested how, having been ordained a while, there are times where there's course correction and going back to that central impulse. It's quite an art.
The thing that you were saying before is interesting as well about. I can't remember exactly how you phrased it, but having an ideal and new behaviour not necessarily living up to that ideal. Because I've had a strong sense of that the last year or so, but I have noticed that things have slightly shifted for me around it as well, that there's a bit of pain around my ethical shortcomings, but there's a bit more space to hold it with a bit of kindness as well. And because of that, probably that's had quite a positive effect as well. Like, I can somehow see my ethical shortcomings a bit more and not be quite so quick to sort of beat myself up. Like, that sort of thing is still there, but somehow I think also as well being around other people where you can be very open about that sort of thing as well, and being able to share those sorts of things and confess more fully, I found really helpful as well. Yeah. Yeah.
I think you
were... We'll come back to you in a second, Alex. Yeah.
You mentioned that you needed sort of the opportunity for silence.
Yeah.
Feelings of...
Yeah.
But how do you kind of deal with that over that 2-year period?
Yeah.
And were you able to kind of discuss that with somebody afterwards?
Yeah, I was definitely able to talk about it with someone afterwards. I mean... Don't tell anybody this. I'll switch the recorder off. I had a chat with someone about it during the silence. There's a badger of silence, but sometimes you share a hut with... This is the other lovely thing. You share a hut with somebody for 4 months. So I shared with a dear friend of mine. And occasionally there's the old whisper, you know. But I was certainly able to talk about it with someone afterwards. And somebody who knows me very well, actually... And it's interesting what comes up in that sort of, when you create so much space that the deepest things can come up. Because I think for me, temperamentally, that's very helpful. Because sort of historically, I've always been somebody who's been very concerned with sort of being very nice and pleasing people and all of that sort of thing. And, you know, there's stuff... But when you try and live in that way all the time, what happens is that stuff gets stuffed deeper and deeper down. You know, so you have to create a lot of space for it to come up. But I think it was part of the natural... It's interesting, it's a 4-month retreat, but it's designed in a very particular way to have certain stages. And it felt like it was a very natural part of the retreat just before ordination. That, you know, you go into the deepest part of the retreat just before you're ordained. And it's also a chance as well for people to, you know, some people decide it's not for them at that point. Or it may be that even someone else decides that it's not for you because of things that happen at that time as well. It's very rare, but it does happen, you know. Yeah. Okay. Alex.
One of the main themes of your talk was about the value of and effect of commitment.
Mm.
And for most of us, one of the main things that we commit to one way or another is some kind of work.
Mm.
And you were talking a little bit about, in a way, why you gravitated towards Tree Ratner.
Mm.
And actually, relatively, the commitment involved in getting ordained is quite amorphous compared to, for example, committing to being a Theravadan monk, where you're committing to a lifestyle that requires you to do specific things at certain times and not do a whole load of things.
Yeah.
So I was wondering how important it's been for you, you might have some more general thoughts about this, to commit to working within the movement as a sort of representation, a form for the to the practice that you've been talking about.
Yeah, you're right, because there's no particular path. It's not like you commit and then you do X or Y. But having said that, I think what you're committing to is a little bit more... It's more weighty and significant, probably, than a particular kind of work or something like that. But it's just difficult to sort of pin down exactly... It's hard to sort of describe that, if you know what I mean. It's sort of got a spiritual weight rather than a kind of a worldly weight. So what you were saying about working within the movement, I partly felt it was good to commit to that because I was so incredibly resistant to doing it. I always thought that it would be something that I wouldn't do. So I thought, oh, I'll teach, I'll lead retreats and stuff like that, but I'll never work in a right livelihood because my work was so important to me. And then I realised actually what I was doing was I sort of wanted to keep that last bit of my life separate. And when the opportunity came up to work at Karanar, it fitted exactly my skill set. And it was like basically I had no reasonable sort of way that I could sit for not doing it. And also, I so leapt at wanting to do that. It was suddenly like this bit of me opened up, and I thought, oh yeah, fantastic. But it's felt important for me particularly to commit to that particular sort of project or workplace, or that it was like I was at the stage where I thought, well, if I'm going to do something, I'll make a commitment to it. And I didn't formally do that, I just did it internally. It was important for me to make a commitment to myself in relationship to that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. It was a longer discussion.
Yeah. Okay. So we're running out of time, I think. So thanks very much for your listening ears. Hope that's been helpful in some way. And so do come along next week, because we're welcoming back the new Dharmacharis. And Sila Pia said they all look very nice and shiny. And it's good to set the scene for that. But it's really, really lovely to hear from people about their experience on their ordination retreats, and to hear about their experience of newly coming back and being welcomed back. So do come along for that if you can. Okay, thanks everyone.